You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
And today we're talking about Facebook, because Facebook owes you money, and here's how you get it. Now, odds are you have a Facebook account because, well, quite frankly, most everybody has a Facebook account. This is coming from various sources, but anybody in the United States who used Facebook in the last 16 years can now collect their piece of a $725 million settlement by parent company Meta, that is the new name of Facebook, basically, and this is tied to their privacy violation. So as long as you fill out a claim on their website, basically, you can get paid out. And here we are. Now, the settlement stems from multiple lawsuits that were brought against Facebook by users who claimed that the company improperly shared their data with third-party sources, such as advertisers and data brokers. Yes, I've been talking about this ad nauseum for years. So while, you know, $725 million is great, it's a slap on the wrist for this company. The litigation, though, began here in this specific instance when Facebook was embroiled in the Cambridge Analytica scandal back in 2018, where they were scraping user data as part of an effort to profile psychologically voters, for the 2018 midterm elections, obviously eventually 2020. They also were caught doing this back in 2016 as well. Ted Cruz used them, Steve Bannon used them, Donald Trump used them, and a whole bunch of others as well. Again, not getting political. Those are just the facts on the ground. Now, Meta denied any liability or wrongdoing under the settlement, which I think is total BS, because they absolutely were wrongdoing here. Now, that's according to the recently created class action website, which is what we're going to talk about here in a second. So this agreement means that U.S. residents who had basically used Facebook between May 24th of 2007 through December 22nd of 2022, that's right, like the end of last year, a few months ago, you can file monetary claim as long as you do that by August 25th of this year. No. So the question obviously is, how on earth do you get your Facebook settlement? You can go to the claim website. And for the record, in basically my YouTube account and in SoundCloud, and I'll try to do this on my social media accounts, I will actually post this information underneath the video and podcast. But you can go to FacebookUserPrivacySettlement.com. Again, that's FacebookUserPrivacySettlement.com. And essentially, there will be a submit claim section where you can get that. You can also print out a claim and mail it to this address. That address is, and this is attention of Facebook Consumer Privacy User Profile Litigation, CO Settlement Administrator, and the address is 1650 Arch Street, Suite 2210, and that's in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19103. Again, that's 1650 Arch Street, Suite 2210, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19103 is the zip code. And again, I will have these in the comments as best as I can. So go check YouTube, SoundCloud, or if you're watching this on social media, I'm going to try and do that. But if not, go to YouTube and SoundCloud, where I can definitely and easily do that. Now, if you're wondering, what on earth do you have to provide information, you have to provide your name, your address, your email, your phone number. If you resided in the United States between those dates, May of 2007 through December of 2022, or if you were a Facebook user between those periods, if you deleted your account during that period and the date range when you were a user, so let's say you deleted Facebook and said, screw this, you still have to say, hey, I was a user from roughly 2007 to 2016 or whenever you got out of it. Obviously, your Facebook username as well. And the payment service provider you prefer. You can use PayPal, Venmo, or a prepaid MasterCard. So if you're asking how long does it take to fill out this form, I went and looked myself. Take you a couple of minutes. It's not hard to get. And so if you're wondering when on earth you're going to get your money, we don't know just yet, because the settlement amount per user is going to depend on how many people fill out this claim. The less people that fill this out, the more money you're going to get. The more people that fill this out, the less you're going to get. It's really that simple. The lawyers, though, obviously get their cut. They're going to get about 25% of the settlement. So the lawyers are going to get like $180 million. That's awesome. Would be nice to be a lawyer on that one. Now, if they receive that much, that means the settlement that is basically whacked up between all of us is $543.7 million. And there you go. So go get your money. When you will get your money, we're not sure exactly, but it should be later this year at the earliest. And the claim sites notes that there is a final approval hearing for the settlement on September 7th of this year, when the court will decide whether to approve the deal and award attorney fees and other costs. If the settlement is approved, the case could still face appeals, which would then take an unknown amount of time to be resolved. Quote, settlement payments will be distributed as soon as possible if the court grants final approval of the settlement and after any appeals are resolved. So Who knows? But either way, Facebook has been violating your privacy since the beginning of their existence. Go get your money. Go get as much of it as you humanly can. I filled it out. I hope you do too. Let's take them to court. And or rather, let's take them to task because they're just in court and here we are. But I think this settlement should have been 10 times larger. And we also gotten 10 times more. There you go. And today we've got to talk about generative AI because it's coming for cybersecurity. I think in the long run, this is really good. We're in the infancy right now, but here's what's going on. And this is coming from Kyle Wiggers of TechCrunch. I think this is important because today, literally today, at the RSA conference, Google announced Cloud Security AI Workbench. Now, this is a security cybersecurity suite powered by a specialized security AI language that they are calling SecPalm. Now, this is an offshoot of Google's Palm model, and SecPalm is, quote, fine-tuned for security use cases. Now, this is incorporating security intelligence, such as research on software vulnerabilities, malware threat indicators, and behavioral threat actor profiles as well. Cloud Security AI Workbench will now span a range of new AI-powered tools like Mandiant's Threat Intelligence AI, which will leverage SecPalm to find, summarize, and act upon security threats. If you remember, Google purchased Mandiant last year for like $5.5 billion. So there you go. On top of this, VirusTotal, which is one of the venerated players for IOCs, indicators of compromise, in the cybersecurity community and actually owned by Google as well, will use SecPalm to help subscribers analyze and explain the behavior of malicious scripts. VirusTotal is usually very good at scanning, you know, files, all that kind of stuff, putting it into sandboxes. They've got a sandbox called Juju to basically look at, like, you know, that infected PDF or whatever. But scripts, I think, are going to be really cool, especially if you have a generative AI look at them. Now, on top of this, elsewhere, SecPalm will also assist customers of Chronicle. This is Google's cloud cybersecurity service in searching for security events and interacting, quote-unquote, conversationally with the results. So this goes beyond the security and information events management systems where they are ingesting the logging from, let's say, your firewall or some kind of threat detection system, and the AI in a SIM or SIEM is starting to sift through the noise to find this. This is taking it one step further, essentially to interact with it. Now, users of Google's Security Command Center AI will get the, quote, human-readable, end quote, explanations of attack exposure courtesy of SecPalm, including impacted assets, recommendation mitigations, and risk summaries for security, compliance, and privacy, and all of that. And basically, in a blog post, Google wrote, and I quote, "While generative AI has recently captured imagination, SecPalm is based on years of foundational AI research by Google and DeepMind and the expertise of our security teams. We've only just begun to realize the power of applying generative AI to security, and we look forward to continuing to leverage this expertise for our customers and drive advancements across the security community." End quote. Now, obviously, that's a pretty bold ambition, especially when you consider that VirusTotal's Code Insight, which is the first tool in the Cloud Security AI Workbench, is only available as a limited preview at the moment. Google says it plans to roll out the rest of these offerings to quote-unquote trusted testers in the coming months. So, like I said, we are in the infancy of this right now. Now, it's not clear how well SecPalm is going to work or, quite frankly, not work at this time. Now, yes, what they are saying is, quote, recommended mitigations and risk summaries, end quote. Those sound useful, but are the suggestions going to be better or more precise because the AI produced them as opposed to a human or, let's say, a standard AI model as opposed to generative AI? I mean, remember, these things make mistakes. They hallucinate. They do other things as well. They're also susceptible to attacks like prompt injections, which can cause them to behave in ways that the creators didn't intend and all of that. And so, again, we are in the infancy of this. And I will reference a study outside of this article that basically put essentially the creation of hardening, cybersecurity programming hardening, in the hands of a generative AI and compared it to both beginner, intermediate, and expert programmers. And overarchingly, the study found that right now the humans are programming more intuitively and more securely than the artificial intelligence is. And that goes for GitHub and a whole bunch of others. Now, obviously, this is Google's cybersecurity-focused artificial intelligence, so we're expecting big things. They're not going to be the last one to do this, though, if they are one of the first. And so here we go. But I think overarchingly, this is good for the cybersecurity community. We have a huge deficit right now. I've written about this for Forbes. I've talked about this on the air, all those kinds of things. And so if we are getting the help of artificial intelligence to make basically intuitive and accurate decisions as it continues to learn, and hopefully as it continues to learn, it becomes even more accurate, more accurate with hopefully different approaches that, let's say, we as humans didn't think about in terms of mitigation, I think this is a really good thing. So we're at the start of this. I think this is a good thing. Sounds like a fun time at RSA. Unfortunately, I could not attend this year due to another engagement, but here we are. Hopefully I'll be back next year because, quite frankly, I love that conference as I do Black Hat. But there you go. Generative AI is coming for cybersecurity. Heads up, criminals. We are about to get way more advanced on you.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
And today, we got to talk about newborn babies because their DNA screenings are becoming a privacy risk, especially for the future. Now, here's what's going on. This is coming from Crystal Grant of the ACLU, and I thought this was really interesting, and I think it's a must-read because, quite frankly, I've written on this personally as to why I won't spit in a tube and send my DNA over to 23andMe or Heritage or, you know, any one of the others because Lord knows I want to, but the privacy risks are too great. But this opens up an angle of DNA screening that I really hadn't considered before because, well, I really didn't know what was going on. And so this is an interesting one. And here's what's going on. And thank you, Crystal Grant, for bringing this to my attention of the ACLU. This is really good. Newborn screening programs, obviously, as we develop new technologies, are very vital to public health. And they've been implemented in the United States and also around the world. And about one third of babies born right now are undergoing some kind of screening when they're new. Now, as part of this program in the United States, almost every baby born has their blood drawn almost immediately after birth, and then that blood is tested for a panel, obviously, of potentially life-threatening inherited disorders. If I've got some rare disease, I definitely want to know if my newborn kid possibly has that inherited disease as well. So current newborn screening programs obviously are invaluable for these reasons, both in lowering medical costs through early detection and intervention, and also decreasing the toll on human suffering that comes from late diagnosis, meaning if we can catch it quickly, we can treat it or, you know, whatever it is. But here's the thing, and I think this is an important part from this article. Unfortunately, innovation in this field is rapidly outpacing the law, which I've talked about numerous times. Technology far outseeds the law, especially when it comes to privacy, and that's leaving families vulnerable to invasions of their privacy. So in October of 2022, a global consortium of scientists and other newborn DNA sequencing researchers convened to discuss the possibility for future care, that every baby born in the United States could have their full genome sequenced as an addition to just the standard screenings that we're getting already, meaning your entire DNA is typed. This means that doctors would have to record all of the baby's DNA in addition to drawing their blood and testing for specific known inherited disorders that can cause serious health problems at birth. The data derived from these blood samples now is fairly limited and only relevant to the health of the child at birth. This includes data on things like date, location, time of birth, mother's name and address, the disorder being screened for, and a value indicating whether the baby is likely to have a hereditary disorder, and there you go. Now, here's where it gets bonkers, though, and this is something that I did not know until I read this, and again, Crystal Grant, thank you, because it doesn't take a lot of imagination, obviously, to figure out how full genome sequencing could be abused. Last year, a public records lawsuit in New Jersey revealed a very, very worrying trend that police were subpoenaing newborn blood samples to implicate a child's relative in a crime, meaning, oh, you suspect whatever, and you just found out that, you know, like, oh, the suspect's sister just had a kid. Well, let's go get the DNA from that kid and put that suspect in the family. Because of a lack of regulation surrounding DNA privacy, something I have written about as well, and one of the reasons why I will not spit in that tube and send it in, the police in some states have been able to access these samples and basically create insanely detailed genetic profiles, and they are using these profiles in criminal investigations. That's crazy. Now, these samples, which are intended only to protect the babies from life-threatening diseases, are now being used by law enforcement to gather highly personal, and detailed genetic information and to generate family trees that could go back generations because you've got the DNA profile in your hands. And so you can upload it to databases like, you know, 23andMe, GED Match, et cetera, et cetera. That's how they found the Golden State Killer. They ran the Golden State Killer's DNA through GED Match, found like a cousin or something like that, and were able to positively identify this person. And while nobody is saying like, oh yeah, no, we shouldn't be finding the serial killers of the world, we have to protect our privacy. Now, on top of this, police departments' systematic mistreatment and of marginalized Americans could also basically put them in greater danger with their genetic information being used against them or being compelled to be taken from them. Now, there is a practice It's the subject of a lawsuit in Orange County, California, where basically the police have been compelling genetic samples from people in exchange for dropping minor charges. And this is part of a quote unquote spit and acquit program, like meaning, oh, like we caught you, I don't know, jaywalking, you know, shoplifting or something like that. You give us your DNA and we'll drop the charges because now they've got you on future stuff. You know, that's absolutely insane. Now, on top of this, police across the country have already constructed their own unregulated genetic database or databases and have accessed medical samples of relatives. In one case, using the cells derived from a woman who had undergone a routine pap smear, all in the name of acquiring more detailed genetic data of people that are, sometimes not even accused of a crime. Now, if states expand their screenings to include the genomic sequencing of newborns without legal protections in place to prevent law enforcement to access this data, it's going to get abused. And I mean, and that's something that I think we really need to understand. And widespread adoption of genome sequencing would allow police not only to continue their current process of acquiring highly sensitive genetic information as part of their investigations, but they could also streamline it. This is what we're talking about. It's also the reason why I'm not a trusted traveler, you know, in TSA, and I travel a lot. The government doesn't have my fingerprints. I'm not going to give more information that is inherently and uniquely mine. DNA is uniquely mine. I'm the only person with my genetic sequence in the entire world, and why I may have cousins or siblings or, you know, obviously parents, we all have parents, you know, et cetera, and I may have relations to them. What makes me uniquely me is simply me. And I think that is something that is so unbelievably important. And Crystal Grant of the ACLU makes another excellent point with this, and I quote directly, though I've been paraphrasing through this entire thing, quote, without ironclad protections, a database containing genetic sequences of every baby born in a state will become a one-stop shop for police. This poses a tremendous cost to public health. If parents are concerned about the privacy of their child's genetic data, they may hesitate to participate in screening programs or opt out entirely, putting their babies at risk, end quote. Meaning, I know that if I have a kid and that kid's genetic sequence is basically in a database in my state or in a national database, every time there's a crime, my child's DNA is going to be run against basically every criminal out there. That's crazy. You know, and you might think, well, Nick, I don't have any criminals in my family. Okay, one, not that you know of, but the point is that we're all in this together. These are the things that make us uniquely ours. We should not be giving this to a state, a government, to anybody without our express consent. The laws have not caught up. And Crystal goes on, this article that she wrote is much longer than what I'm just paraphrasing and riffing off of here to talk about the laws and how we can change this in the lawmakers. I highly recommend that you go read this on the ACLU's website. When I went looking for privacy news, this one was shocking to me. And if you've recently had a kid, understand that their DNA is no longer uniquely theirs. That is a huge thing, especially if they've been sequenced. And these are things that we legitimately need to change. And we've got some senators out there. Ron Wyden, for example, of Oregon, is doing the cyber lord's work when it comes to privacy online, privacy for these kinds of things. I mean, if we have a right to privacy in the Constitution, it has to extend into the advancements of technology. There should be no exceptions for that. The police, if they need this, should be able to get a warrant signed by a judge as opposed to simply saying, oh, you know, we'll spit and acquit. So now we're building our own unregulated database where we don't need warrants to run this, or we can go to GED match and run my DNA for whatever reason. These are things that are just absolutely abhorrent to me. And I think that this is a huge problem. So once again, go read that article. Thank you, Crystal Grant of the ACLU. And I guess you can't say you haven't been told.
Oh, and real quick, don't forget to follow me on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, basically your favorite social media platform. I'm either at Nick AESP or / Nick Espinoza at any one of those. Come feel free to follow me. It's always a good time. I do daily content on tech, on privacy, on cybersecurity. You'll be informed. I think it'll be interesting. So stick around and make sure to follow me.
I knew this day was going to come. We have to talk about ransomware for Macs. And it's rather prolific. Now, this is coming from 9to5 Mac, and here's what's going on. Over the last several years, the Lockbit ransomware gang has become one of the most powerful ransomware gangs on the planet, hands down. They've taken the mantle from R-Evil. There's no doubt about it. Now, they've obviously, in the past, focused on Windows, Linux, and virtual host machines, but now they're targeting Macs. Now, basically, this was discovered by Brett Callow of Malware Hunter Team, and it seems to be possibly the first ransomware build designed specifically for Mac OS, And here we are. Now, it's not fully clear at this time, but it may also be the first major ransomware gang that is specifically targeting Apple devices. Lockbit is believed, for the record, to be a Russian group and has members that are Russian-speaking. However, their leader has said that he operates either out of the United States or China, so here we are. But per all best guesses, given all of their indicators of compromise, tactics, etc., everybody believes that, for the most part, there's a high confidence that they are Russian-based. Now, they run what's known as a RAS, or ransomware as a service operation. Basically, they would let you use their ransomware for a price, and then they just get a cut of the profit, etc., etc. This is a very common thing now. So if you don't know how to make ransomware or create ransomware or run your terror campaign, you can go to them and they will help you out. And obviously, here we are. Now, it looks like this ransomware, specifically from Lockbit, was created for Apple Silicon Macs, with the name being Locker_Apple_M1_64. Now, essentially, the InfoSec Twitter account VX Underground mentioned the appearance of this Lockbit ransomware strain for Mac showing up in one place with a date of November 2022. But Malware Hunter team says they haven't found any mentions of it online, and here we are. So it appears that this has been basically under the radar since possibly around last fall. On top of that, or in any case, Malware Hunter team believes that this is the first public alert about Lockbit going after Apple devices specifically. And with this gang's ransomware as a service approach, it's possible that we're going to see an incoming wave of ransomware attacks, Lockbit being very good at what they do. Now, interestingly enough, too, while the M1 ransomware build is grabbing a lot of attention because, you know, the M1 processor, you know, from Apple and all of that, Lockbit has also built one apparently showing up for PowerPC Macs as well. And so if you are a Mac user, heads up, do not believe the hype. One of the biggest just headaches that we have in the cybersecurity community is Apple's marketing. I'm not kidding, because Apple, I mean, if you even remember back in the day, like 10 plus years ago, they had John Hodgman and Justin Long, like, I'm a Mac, I'm a PC, you know, that kind of thing. Even back then, it's like, well, if I have a Mac, I never get infected. I never get infections. It's total junk. It's marketing garbage. You get infected, you've all the time. Now, ransomware may be a relatively new thing, but Lockbit being as prolific as they are, we are going to start seeing this show up, and as individual users and some companies, especially, let's say, more you know, flashy companies, if you will, start adopting Mac over Windows and stuff like that, we are going to see companies also getting locked out with this as well. So this will be a huge thing. I can see this targeting things like college campuses, where you've got tons of students with MacBooks because that's what they want, et cetera, getting hit with this. So this is a huge thing. Heads up, Mac users. But again, don't believe the hype. If you have a Mac, you have to defend it the same way that you would defend a Windows machine or Linux or anything else. You need good threat detection. You need good cyber hygiene. You need good training and education. Don't believe the marketing hype from Apple. This is something I've talked about ad nauseum over the years. And now it's really coming to fruition, because while you've always been able to get infected, you MacBook folks or you Mac people, now it's turned up to 11 and you're in the same boat with the rest of us. And that's something that you should have already been prepared for. And if not, get moving. Super important. And today we're talking about Southwest Airlines, because Southwest Airlines is proving that technology debt is a very serious problem out there. And we will get to what technology debt is. But first, let me give you the backdrop of today's story. If you recall, in December of last year, 2022, Southwest Airlines, which is a major U.S. carrier for those outside of the country, they're one of the major airlines here in the United States. They are the second largest, basically, domestic carrier by passenger volume, canceled more flights than usual, including more than 60% of their flights within 2 days. Now, that disruption to operations was described by publications as the most costly and largest in the history of U.S. airlines. More than 15,000 flights were canceled throughout that two-day crisis. And here's why. According to Michael Santoro, the vice president of the Southwest Airlines Pilot Association, or SWAPA, he indicated that Southwest had not invested in updated software systems. Now, there had been complaints for a decade from members of the Flight Attendants Union that the technology behind Southwest's scheduling system was outdated. Earlier in 2022, SWAPA campaigned Southwest not for increased pay and benefits. Those are the traditional goals of a labor union, or airline workers' labor union in this case, but rather to pressure Southwest Airlines to improve their crew scheduling technology. SWAPA said that the inflexibility of the airline scheduling system was causing it to cancel many delayed flights because the crew's allowable duty hours were going to expire. The airline would then lose track of crews, forcing them to sleep on airport floors or find hotel rooms for themselves. Usually, if you're a flight crew, you have an assigned hotel. They've got rooms for you. That's all part of the deal when you're signing up to be a pilot or a flight attendant and you're not home. The airline could also not efficiently locate and dispatch backup crews to operate delayed flights. Now, Southwest themselves came out and said they're going to be upgrading their systems and modernize this technology, basically to fix this entire issue. And I warned back then that Southwest flyers should have a heads up and expect future delays and issues due to the fixing of their technology debt. And sure we are. Sure enough, here we are today, because almost 2,000 Southwest airline flights are now delayed or were delayed today after a system-wide computer glitch grounded fleet and obviously left frustrated passengers stuck in terminals and trapped on planes on tarmacs. The nationwide stop started around 9:45 a.m. I'm assuming that's Eastern time, persisted for almost 2 hours. And for roughly an hour and a half or so, captains were assuring their customers that their planes would take off and they were grounded due to a software malfunction, while an explanation from the company's representative said that disruptions basically stemmed from, quote, intermittent technology issues. Now, the Federal Aviation Administration eventually lifted that pause at 11:10 a.m., revealing the order was issued at the airline's request while staffers worked to resolve, quote, data connection issues resulting from a firewall failure, end quote. Now, according to data provided by flight tracker FlightAware, 1,982 Southwest flights were experiencing delays earlier today, and that was what we knew from this morning. And that is the problem with technology debt. Now, we've had conflicting reports. Is it a firewall issue? Is it a software glitch? Et cetera, et cetera. We're not sure. Maybe it's a software glitch and a firewall. But the point is that technology debt is a huge thing. And understand what technology debt is. Let's say your company invests in, easy numbers, a database for 100 users. As time goes on and technology improves, maybe the 100 users becomes 200, 300, 1,000, whatever it is, and you're spending more and more money to update and essentially maintain antiquated systems that were designed, let's say, to handle 100 users, and now you're pumping 300 users into it, 400 users, 500 users, and obviously you're running into issues, whether it's delays, whether it's corruption of the data, meaning you can't access things. This is essentially what we are talking about. And that's the deep dive for this week. Thanks for tuning in. We didn't have time for the regular exit. There was just so much news. I'll see you next time.